Let's bring Patrick Johnson, our weekly guest, into the conversation. Canucks insider from the Vancouver province. I mean, this has been a long conversation this week, PJ, and I'm sure you've read a lot and talked a lot and thought a lot about it. And the one thing, and we even discussed this a little bit with Elliot on Tuesday, like, I'm aware, like, here I am a white guy, and I'm about to ask another white guy of, like, hey, what are the responsibilities of NHL players? Like, I get it, and I understand that it's not necessarily for us to say what's right and what's wrong in all this, but it has been interesting watching and reading kind of how these statements from NHL players have grown. Not that the early ones were so bad, but it feels like McDavid's today and Crosby's today and Patrice Bergeron's today, these are getting more and more thoughtful. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. I go back to something I think I learned when I was still a teacher. And you think about how to get kids to engage with their own experiences, their own understandings of the world, and sort of encourage the idea of critical thinking. And that means, many ways in certain level, finding your own truth, but trying to understand what other people are dealing with and trying to understand what, that your experience isn't the same as everyone else's. One of the challenges in that process when as I taught social studies, in that process is people are afraid of saying the wrong thing. And it's something I think that's wired into us from very early on. I think most of us are not instinctually wired to be a disruptor, to be a leader, to be outside the norm, which is what sort of our comfortable safe zone. And, we all have our own accommodations in that sense. And, one of the biggest challenges I remember learning as a teacher was how to encourage kids to feel comfortable to ask a question or to say something that they weren't sure about, but it was okay. And it's funny, I find myself thinking again about a moment I had last year when I was writing a story early on about Elias Pettersson, sort of trying to get a sense of who he is. And, it was one of those ones where it's like, well, let's talk to the people who are getting to know him better than those of us who do the stories. And I was talking to Brock Besser, and I asked him, I was honestly pretty in, run-of-the-mill questions, just trying to get a sense of what he knew about his new friend. And we got to the end, and Brock sort of said something along the lines of I'm not really sure if that's what you're looking for, and it was a bit of a from that same vein, I'm not sure this is the right answer, but, which is what you often get from high school students, I'm not sure this is the right answer, but, and you're like, that's okay, it's you're trying to engage with it. You're starting from a point of mostly you don't know anything, and that's fine. And I think from our perspective, you're right. I mean, there's a thread that's gone around, and it stuck with me, and I feel terrible because, of course, I'm drawing a blank on the fellow's name, but who's a black man in America, and he said, share with me your stories the first time you felt your color. Mm-hmm. And it's an endless series of repliers from people of a variety of ages in Canada and in the U.S. talking about, and mostly I think black people, but other people of color talking about, the first time they were pulled over by a cop for simply being in the wrong neighborhood, or, the shopkeeper kept an eye on them. They were 10 years old and the shopkeeper watched them all the way through. And when they walked out, they realized the shopkeeper's other hand, the reason why they couldn't see it was because they had their hand on a shotgun. And that's an experience that I've never even contemplated. I think honestly for most of my life. And that's not to say I didn't imagine that it existed, but that's simply not like my experience has been in the end. That is what my privilege is I have never had to think about those things. It's never been part of my experience. And yet that's kind of the point, is that this is the experience for so many people, and it should not be that way. And it's something to work against, and it's difficult and it's hard. And that's partly why I think, to come back to the original question, was why it is so hard for people to stand out. Hockey players are used to not having to do it, because they simply don't have to do it, because most of their experience has never been a scenario where they, let alone have gone through it themselves or have had to say anything about it. It's, that's kind of the truth of hockey. We want more people to be in it. And I, you know, one of the great things about Vancouver is that we're such a diverse market. People, you know, who come from outside the market talk about it all the time, that we actually are the multicultural fan base that, you know, I think the NHL would I think all honestly love to have, because that means that's a ton of fans. And there's work to do, I think, beyond this market, but that's not to say that there isn't work to do here. So, I mean, that's a long rambling answer to your question, but you're right. It is weird two white guys talking about this, because it's not something we've ever experienced. But I think the important thing in that has been put forth is that, first of all, that we're listening, we're putting ourselves aside, listening to what's happening, and then engaging and saying, yes, this matters, this is important, how do we get better? And then following the lead of people who have done a lot of thinking about this and have the smartest ideas out there.
The question is this a great awakening that we're seeing, or is it just a fad in the moment that people are supporting and then it kind of goes by the wayside? Because we've never seen hockey players, PJ, speak out on a social issue the way they have, especially obviously because it's a predominantly white sport. A lot of white hockey players speaking out and saying things and not mincing words in their statements, something that I honestly was not expecting. I'm not going to sit here and say I'm impressed and applaud them, but it's a step that I was not expecting to see from a lot of white athletes.
I think, you know, there is a safety in numbers. And I think, as you said, I mean, it's almost a bit of once the dam bursts. I think, you know, we look at, obviously, we'd heard a lot from Evander Kane late last week, and then Taves on the weekend, and Blake Wheeler, I think. I mean, those are the two that stand out the most, but I know there have been others. It's the safety in numbers aspect, I think, which unfortunately is an instinct that I think hockey players especially have. You know, you don't want to stick out, a bit of that fear of the tall, being the tall poppy, which is an old-time Canadian trait that drives me nuts. Don't be the tallest poppy, but there's nothing wrong with that. Say what you feel. It's hard, I know, but there's a lot of people out there that feel the same way, and it is important. I think it is, you know, it is important that hockey have leaders like that. You know, that at the end of the day, everyone feels comfortable to say that. I think, you know, I've said this before in other contexts around hockey especially, but I think in many ways, the shift that we've seen in education, and I think this is something I'm aware of because of my background as a teacher, the shift that we've seen the last 20 years, last 30 years, towards, you know, more sort of outward-looking perspectives, getting away from the old kind of just filling in worksheets, the sort of memorizing facts, learning skills. You know, I think we're more and more going to see that emerge in hockey players, because that's literally how they're wired. You talk with a young player and you talk with a coach like Travis Green. I've talked about this before, that Travis understands that players want to be involved in the process, and that's not a bad thing. And that, you know, if they understand where you're coming from, they're going to accept the decision, which is not something that I think players, even of Travis's vintage, were wired to do. Certainly people my age and your guys' age are right in the wheelhouse of that shift in how schools kind of set our brains up. And I think the more that happens, we are going to see more and more of that happening, because in the end, it is important that you have longstanding leaders in your culture, like Jonathan Taves, like Blake Wheeler, say this, because it makes the guys, you know, it makes players on the edge, makes players in the sort of that great middle who aren't sure what to think, do some thinking. And, you know, nobody has to come to exactly the right answer. It comes back to what I was saying about teaching. You don't want, you know, you don't want to make people think, well, there's only one way to think, but you do want to make sure they're thinking in just ways and that they're understanding justice and they're understanding what people are dealing with in day-to-day lives that is not their experience, that your experience is great and that's awesome and hopefully it is so. But there are people who are not having that experience, and oftentimes it's not their fault. And, you know, I think in the end, is this a big shift? It could be. You hope so. Cynically, I think we say it's not. But, you know, we've seen time and again how much, I mean, the sporting analogies are obvious, right? But we've seen time and again how important, how well, how much success we have when we're working together and not working separately.
Patrick Johnson joins us here on the program. Andrew Walker, Satyar Shah, Sportsnet 650. So the Judd Brackett story kind of came to a culmination on Friday. And I mean, it feels like, especially in this market, this is a story that will be referenced for years from now every time we're looking back at the Canucks draft history. But but I mean, the front office does appear to be getting smaller, right? Trevor Linden was never truly replaced, and right. I don't know if instantly they'll replace Judd Brackett with another guy of his experience in the organization. So is the circle getting tighter? Does that mean there's less voices and less disagreement? And I think a lot of fans have this idea that the entire scouting procedure of the Canucks is gonna change from what they know. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, certainly on that last point, I think that's certainly likely. I mean, there's been one philosophy is being removed from the mix, and so in the end, it comes back to, I mean, Jim Benning told you guys this is why he was hired. I mean, this is about his own pedigree and his own brand, and you know what, he knows it. That's the deal. In terms of the size of the front office, I mean, it is, I think I have to be fair in the context. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of people that are hiring in the current economic environment. That said, it's something I noted last year, last summer, a year out from Trevor Linden leaving, that, yeah, he hadn't been replaced. You go back further. At that point, Lawrence Gilman and Lauren Henning had not been replaced. Chris Gear has been promoted, but my understanding, certainly don't understand that there's anybody below him that sort of essentially replaced him 100%. There's not been a lot of like-for-like movement in that front office. And, yeah, there's fewer people. And, I mean, this is not, I would say, unique to the Canucks. There is a general trend in hockey that remains so that they tend to have these smaller front offices for, I think in big picture reasons, baffle me a little bit. I mean, you look at the size of front offices in most other North American professional sports, and there are a lot of people, more than ever, doing jobs that I think most of us never would have imagined 20 years ago. And certainly in hockey, that's still not the case. For the most part, I think, they are to be commended for having built themselves a small little analytics group. That's good because that helps you with your decisions. But I think the reality is more than ever, that there's just so much data more than ever. I mean, you look at the tracking system that's supposed to come in. I mean, I can't remember. Was it coming in for the playoffs? Was it coming for next season? I've lost track. But,
they're not doing it in the playoffs this year, so they're going to bring it in next season.
Right. So the data tracking, I mean, you're literally going from hundreds of data points to like thousands, tens of thousands from what I can recall.
You're going to need a complex algorithm to be able to go through all these specific, because it's like thousands upon thousands of variables that need to be put into a system that makes sense of it.
Yeah, and you need people to crunch the numbers, and that's just reality. And there's going to be teams that are going to be doing that well. There's teams that are already doing that well. And, if you really want to be a championship team, you're going to have to do that, whether you like it or not, because it's simply going to be, it is a case of keeping up with the Joneses, but it's also keeping yourself up in the arms race, right? The other guy has better stuff. You better have just as good stuff. There's a reason why there's only ever two teams or three teams that win in Formula One. It's because those teams can afford it. And if you can't afford it in hockey, you're all of a sudden going to find yourself falling behind, I think. I mean, there is still lots of luck involved in hockey. There's no denying that. You talk to a stats guy, he will tell you that they're accounting for something like sometimes as little as like 25% of the game, 75% of the game. It's kind of out of their control. You kind of depends on whether you have good players or not, and that's kind of it. And whether your coach is not, working against himself. I think it is an interesting point for the Canucks. There's no doubt about it. The scouting aspect is shifting. But in the bigger picture, there's a lot to deal with, and you said it, Andrew. I mean, whether Trevor Linden was doing a good job or not, he was in that job doing the things that a president does. And you know, you find yourself wondering what this team, you know, what the front office is going to look like, you know, when the season restarts. Let's maybe, I think we know, but certainly, you know, whenever next season starts, you find yourself wondering how that comparison is going to look.
Well, that's a big question. And I think the reality here too is the Canucks could be on the verge of entering into a new glory era with the young guys they have. Like, there is a nucleus here to build around. The question really comes down to, can you make the right moves in the next 2 or 3 years that really will determine how the next decade goes to a large degree? I mean, you're always going to be working on moves and always building your roster. It's more than just the next couple of years. But it's a critical point right before Pettersson and Hughes get their big contracts. So they're right on that verge here of doing something big. You start looking at how the front office has shifted. And I know Jim has mentioned he doesn't play politics, but for a guy who says he doesn't play politics, he has survived a lot of political issues throughout his tenure in the organization. And now very much, it is his show. It is John Weisbrod's show.
Yep.
I mean, these are the guys. And now there is no impediments, really. If you start looking, you don't have a rationale 2 years from to say, well, we had people in the front office that didn't agree with us. You've had all this time now. So it's so critical that everything has been removed. So now this is completely on the shoulders of Jim Benning and to a lesser degree, John Weisbrod. And they've survived all this. And, you know, whether they want to talk about being political or not, they have survived a lot of these political fights. And the question is, do they have the aptitude to take this team to that next step? And that's my biggest question here, PJ.
You know, and I think it's that. I think it's also just sort of I'm trying to avoid war analogies given the current state of the world, but you know,
right.
What are you bringing to the competition? You know, what are you bringing forward? What are you setting up? Are you setting yourself up to succeed? Have you done everything you can? And you know, like I said, I am of the view that the sort of more people you have in your process, the better you're off you are. There's a great book. I know people still have lots of time to fill because we're still not back to normal. Great book I can recommend called Range by David Epstein. And it's all about the idea of how essentially the most successful organizations who make the best decisions, who set themselves up best for success, are ones that have a variety of perspectives in their decision-making process that aren't leaning too heavily on one or two people, that don't lean too heavily on specialists, that they rely on generalists. And I certainly think the Canucks at this time are at risk of having not enough people involved in their process, because that opens you up to mistakes. You only know what you can see in front of you, and you only know your own experience. And sometimes people, you know, people having different experiences in any decision-making process helps. It's not a question of that arguments are bad or that different opinions are bad. It's that, you know, you understand how you're going from point A to point B to point C, and that you're not just sort of hoping that you end up in the right place. You know, there's so many other analogies I could draw, but I mean, I think at the end of the day, it really comes down to, you know, recognizing that, you know, what you want to do is be a champion. Well, how did other teams become champions? It's not what you think makes a champion, actually. It's what other places have actually done, and then learning from those lessons. And, you know, I think if you're not applying those lessons, if you're not trying to understand what other people did, how other people came to those, that success, you're never going to get there.
He is Patrick Johnson from the Vancouver Province. Well, he's not criticizing Sat and my ratings. He's our weekly guest.
Hey, I came back just here, boys.
By the way, I went for my first round of golf on the course that which you live in close proximity to. So I was gonna message you and ask for like a backyard beer, but it was very early, and I thought maybe you'd judge me.
No, I'd never judge you.
Okay, so
come by.
Except in your articles. No.
I will judge you at all.
I know, I'm joking. I will text you next time.
All right, boys.
All right, Patrick Johnson from the Vancouver Province.